just asking you to imagine this. I want you to imagine that I had a medical doctor who was my medical doctor. He was a family practitioner, and I just thought the world of him. And so if I got sick, I'd go see him, and he would help me out. If I got some kind of disease, I would go see him. If my back started hurting him, I'd go see him. If I was having trouble with my appetite, I'd go see him. If I was having some question about my weight, I'd go see him. If I wanted to put on weight, I'd go see him. If I wanted to take it off, I'd go see him. I'd pretty much go see him for everything. I'd go see him for stress. I just thought the world of him, and I wanted you to think the world of him too, and I wanted you to go see him, not because he was giving me a referral, but just because I thought that he was an essential part of a good life for me, and without him, I would be nothing, and I want you to have him too. And if you didn't have him, I'd feel very anxious about it. As a matter of fact, I might even lie awake at night thinking, what's going to happen if people around me don't go to this guy as their medical doctor? Now, what would you think about me if that were the case? Maybe at first you think, golly, that guy is just really dedicated to his doctor. But after a while, some of you may be thinking, I wonder if he's giving him some illegal prescriptions, and that's why Mark is so dedicated to him. Or you may be thinking, that Mark is quite a fanatic. Or you may be thinking, bless his heart, that's fine and good, but I think he's way overemphasizing the value of that medical doctor. Indeed, the anxiety he's feeling over everyone else having the same doctor and getting the same experience, that's probably not a good thing. I don't know many people who are that dedicated to their medical doctors, and there's probably a lot of reasons for that. One of them is because we all know we're going to die of something, right? And we all know you cure one disease, another one crops up. But yet, I find it interesting how often we look at politicians and the political process as the be-all, the end-all, and we can become very anxious about it. Indeed, we can treat it like it is life or death and survival. Now, if you press us, we can tell you in the back of our mind, oh, you get one president in, another problem will come up, and so he'll go out of office, and another president will come in, he'll address that one, but then another one, we could solve this problem, another one's going to crop up, or you get the wrong guy in, he'll mess things up for a while, but we'll get the right one. We can tell you, analytically, intellectually, rationally, there's always going to be political problems. But yet, if we're not careful, even those of us who are Christians, we can lie awake at night anxious over what is happening, anxious over what is going to happen. How many of you used to watch the 10 o'clock news at night? How many of you don't do that anymore? Because if you do, you will get so upset, so angry, so anxious, you won't be able to sleep. I don't watch the news. I haven't watched it for years. I don't get on my computer and look up the news stories from Twitter or whatever. I don't want to run the risk. It's kind of like a guy walking by a magazine that may be mainstream, but boy, there may be that one picture in there that can inflame his passion and lust. But in this case with the news, his passion and lust for anger and conflict and for making myself the center of the universe to get the problem solved. And I'm not up for that. But that's the world we live in, is it not? Now, here's the dirty little secret. It's been that way for 200 years here. Matter of fact, I was at a Toastmasters meeting, I think in 2016, because a guy got up and made a speech, and he read campaign literature, and we were sitting there thinking, this is from the current campaign, and he said, ladies and gentlemen, this is from the campaign of 1840. But it was the sides firing volleys at each other, and just the anger and vitriol, and you realize it's pretty much always been that way. Oh, there are some patterns where it's really high and inflamed. And then there's times when it's not so bad, but there's always something there. And so what we want to talk about this morning is the perils of trusting in the wrong kingdom. Because I actually want to take you back about 3,000 years where it was going on in the time of ancient Israel as well. And I want to let this passage remind us of the call of God, as Alan mentioned, to trust in Him and to recognize His sovereignty. Now I understand, again, we got to live in this world and we got to endure it. Going back to medical science, I have an acquaintance who just last week in Tyler announced that he has cancer and it doesn't look good. And this guy is very impactful in our city, and he's a fairly young guy. And he gave one of the greatest testimonies to faith that I have ever heard. He trusts in God's sovereignty. Indeed, God will take him home if he dies. However, who wants to go through that? So I get the tension. We can trust in God, but who wants to go through sometimes what He leads us through? And if you're a guest, what we've been looking at is some of those things God leads us through. And we started about 4 weeks ago in this series. We started with the creation. And we talked about how God was at work those 6 days of creation. And there's all kinds of things going on. And if we had the chance to magically be there, we would look up going, this is too chaotic. And yet, God would be knowing what He was doing the whole time. And then there's a time of rest. Day 7, God rested. And it seems like He's been working on that rhythm ever since, with the children of Israel, calling them out of Egypt. And then He leads them to a geographical cul-de-sac. And it's chaos. The Egyptian army is fixing to get them. And then God opens up the Red Sea and they pass through. God knew what He's doing all along. That song that Dayton just led us in, we looked at that story briefly a couple weeks ago. Jesus is leading the disciples, and they're thinking, hey, yay, we're following Jesus. Hey, we're going on a boat with Jesus. We're alone with Jesus. And all of a sudden, the storm hits. It is chaos. Jesus has no idea what's going on here. Oh, yes, He does. This was from His creation. And at just the right time, He told the storm, Sabbath, rest, stop, peace. But the disciples had trouble following that rhythm. And we do too. And so if you're a guest, this is the passage we find ourselves in this morning in this series. And it just so happened that you caught us just right. I usually do Father's Day's and Mother's Day sermon, but I didn't get to do one here for Mother's Day. I didn't want to be unfair, so I didn't do one for Father's Day either. So anyway, but hey, we fathers get anxious about the political process sometimes, do we not? So maybe it will be totally appropriate. And I just realized I got my car keys right here, but they don't do a good job turning the slide. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to exchange that for the other one, which feels just like my car keys in the pocket. Okay. Have you ever seen this sign in front of a church building? I think it may have been a church building. Actually, it may have been the Chamber of Commerce. Who knows? But can Christians get so angry and so upset that they post on Facebook things that if they had a chance to project later how they would feel about what they said or what they communicated or how it looked, they'd be kind of embarrassed, regret that? It happens a lot. Maybe it's in our DNA. I don't know. But if you get here in Samuel, what you have is you've got God in chapter 7 and 8 working to get the Israelites delivered from the Philistines, specifically in this way. They had taken the Ark of the Covenant. God's people got it back. But as we talked about last week, they put God in a box and hit Him, because they didn't want to have anything to do with His mighty power. And so they wrestle with their idolatry and just some of these things that we're still tempted to do today, incidentally. And then Samuel, in his leadership, helps them to have a mighty victory over the Philistines. But you've got a problem here, because if you get to chapter 8, verse 1, when Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges for Israel. The name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second was Abijah, and they served at Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. Probably a good sermon just in that verse right there in terms of government, public service, political process, religion. But I'll pass on that for today. Verse 4, so all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. But when they said, give us a king to lead us, this displeased Samuel, so he prayed to the Lord. Now, I want to go ahead and insert this here because I'm fixing to shift a little bit, but their concern was justified. God's will was not being done. There was chaos in Israel, but it was not holy chaos coming from God, God's creative work. It was chaos created by man, in this case specifically, Samuel's two sons. And they were engaged in abominable things, and they're doing these things in the name of the Lord. And so the elders of Israel basically came to Samuel and said, you know what, Samuel, it's time. You've done some remarkable things, but we're not in a good place. And so it's time that we had a king. Samuel took this very personally. And if you look at verse 7, And I think this is very poignant. And the Lord told him, Samuel, listen to all the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected as their king, but me. As they have done from the day I brought them out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do. Samuel told the words of the Lord to the people who are asking him for a king. He said, this is what the king who reign over you will do. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses. They will run in front of his chariots. He will assign to be commanders of thousands, commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. Do you see what's happening here? He's basically describing the formation of a government. They're going to go from tribes to more of a nation. They're going to bring people out of their communities to serve in this government. And, in essence, they will assess taxes. And so this is a game changer in a lot of ways. Now, if you will pick it up in verse 18, when that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day. But the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Now, let me stop right there. Let me remind you something that you learned in Bible school. But it is important that we remember this. If you'll turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 17, as God was instructing Moses about invading this new land and taking over, he has some interesting instructions. Deuteronomy 17, if you look at verse 14, God tells Moses, when you enter the land the Lord your God has given you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, you will say, let us set a king over us like all the nations around us. Be sure to point over you the king the Lord your God chooses. He must be from your own brothers. And he goes on and describes in some more detail what he expects of this new king. And I don't really want to go into that right now, because I think it's outside the realm of our discussion for today. But my main point is, just to remind you, God anticipated a king someday for his people. As a matter of fact, let me just insert this right here. I'm not going to spend too much time on this today, but if I speculate that if they were going according to the Lord's calendar, that this would continue to be a time of Sabbath And that if the Lord's preferred will had taken place, the first king of Israel would have been a man after his own heart. Does that ring a bell? Can you think of a verse in 1 Samuel that mentions that God has selected a man after his own heart to be king? Yeah, David. There is a man that God is looking to. And I speculate if God's preferred will, you know what I mean when I say God's preferred will. There are things that God prefers and say, well, you're asking me, here's what you should do, but we don't ask him. And he doesn't stop us from doing what we're going to do, but he had his preferred will. And then there's times when he has his sovereign will. Well, Jesus is going to go to the cross, die on the cross, and be raised from the dead. Absolutely, that was God's sovereign will. That was going to happen whether people wanted it or not. So you got God's sovereign will, God's preferred will. I speculate God's preferred will was that the first king be David. I cannot prove that. It's just sheer speculation. God allowed Israel to go down the path that they're about to go down here. And does anybody remember who this first king they pick is? Anybody? Saul, yeah. Saul. Do you remember why Saul was selected? What was it that motivated these folks? Well, big one is right here. If you look at chapter 8, verse 20, they already said, no, we want a king. And then you look at verse 20, then we will be like all the other nations with a king to lead us and to go out before us and to fight our battles. We want to be like everybody else. It's too hard to live to the Spirit. It's too hard to follow God in these intangible ways, to say God is our king. It's just too hard. It's too easy to go by the things we see, feel, hear, and touch. And so if we look and see how they're doing it, and if they're doing it well, we can do the same thing. We can replicate that. So let's get us a king. What kind of king we'll get? Well, let's get us a guy that looks good. We want somebody that looks good on TV. And they get him, don't they? Because what's different about Saul? He's head and shoulders over everyone else. Just evidently a very impressive guy. And so this is the one who's going to be their king. And so we're going to talk about next week and to come some of the things that Saul does. And we're going to talk about the problem that Saul brings to God's people, because Saul is a great example of someone who does not walk closely with God, someone who wants things his own way. And when God says, okay, wait for it, Saul says, nope, I want to move. And God says, move. Saul says, no, I just want to stay here for a moment. He's totally out of sync. And it hurts him, and it hurts God's people. But that's another sermon that's to come. What I want to finish up with today is I really want to emphasize how tempting it is to do what these people here do. And that is, they create idols. And in their case, the idols are politics. And they look at their political process as the solution to all of their problems. Is that easy to do today? Absolutely. Because again, as I mentioned a while ago, we can say God's in charge and I get cancer. Okay, that's all right because God's in charge. Well, it's easy to say that. But then if I get it, all of a sudden, that's not too fun. I prefer to live a life where God's in charge, but I don't get cancer. So I need to, as I start headed toward my conclusion here and finishing up, I really want to hit this home. If you're sitting here going, you know, well, he's preaching to me, he's pontificating and all that. No, I'm really not trying to do that. Now, I'm not trying to be dishonest. I'm never going to run for Pope, but if I'm ever elected, I will serve. So I love pontificating as much as anybody. But what I'm trying to do here is to preach to you and to preach to me. This is not our ultimate hope. The political process and the results are not our ultimate hope. And again, just so you understand my heart, when I was 22, some of you knew my dad, or if you saw a picture, you might remember him, because he would come out and visit every once in a while when I preached out here back in 1980. Well, he died when I was 22. I had just graduated from college, died of cancer. And he had made me the executor of his estate. So I shut down my plans and went home to Winsboro and went to his office and started trying to manage that estate. And about a month in, a judge in town came to see me. And he closed the door, and I immediately thought, oh, what have I done now? I'm in trouble. And he almost started crying. I think he did start crying. But anyway, my dad had served on the school board, and this guy had thought highly of my dad. And he asked me if I would be willing to serve out my dad's term. Now, my plan was, in basically a semester, finish up the managing the estate, get it all set up, and then take off and start graduate school. But I got to tell you, I was tempted. I thought, well, is this an opportunity or not? And the chance to, I don't want to say to serve in politics, I want to say public service. That sounds better, doesn't it? And so I seriously considered it. I went out to Abilene, talked to some of my mentors, and I'll never forget one guy saying, well, you just spent 4 years preparing for your life's calling of ministry, foreign mission work. Are you sure you want to turn on a dime and do this? And that really hit home. So decided not to do that, turned down that opportunity. But even going back to Abilene didn't take me out of the political process, because I was serving in the real estate business to put myself through graduate school, and it just so happened that the West Texas region needed somebody to represent them in the political action committee. And so they kept on turning to this guy or this girl. She'd say no. He'd say no. They kept going down the line, and finally they got to me, and I was so young and inexperienced, they didn't give me a choice. I had to do it. And so, that's right, ladies and gentlemen, I became a lobbyist. Now, it was unpaid. I wish it was paid. I could have made some good money. It was just strictly volunteer. But I say that to say that if you ever found that out, I don't want you to hold it against me. I won't tell you right up front. I was, in that sense, involved in the political process. Now, I want to tie that to the words I use, public service. You know, sometimes people get in and they see how things are made and they go, oh, they become disillusioned. It was the other way around. I came in cynical, but I actually encountered enough people that impressed me as human beings who were doing public service that it actually gave me a pretty good feeling. Our congressperson, it was a cotton farmer from West Texas, a congressman. And I'll never forget one of the first meetings, I saw him sitting there and somebody asked him a question, and he said, I don't know, which I never thought I'd hear from a politician. And he turned to his assistant and said, would you get this person's name and phone number, contact information? Let's find out that answer. But just very transparent when he knew, when he didn't. We would go to Austin. Don't worry, they didn't let me talk, the other lobbyists. But I would sit there and listen, and so they would talk and say, we don't want you to raise taxes and all this stuff. And these representatives, I remember some of them saying, I'm sorry, but here's what we're dealing with. We feel like we have to. So I'm saying what I'm saying, and I took a long time to tell you this, but it's very important for me that you don't walk away thinking, I have it out for these politicians. I have it out, and I'm cynical. No, I'm really not. As I mentioned earlier, medical doctors, I have a preacher friend who says, those involved in public service are like medical doctors to society's ills. There are things that are diseased and sick, and they do what they can to help heal. But they recognize that we live in a fallen world, and there's always going to be sickness. And I like that description. That's a good thing for us to think about. These are public servants, and there will always be ills in society. It's never going to get fixed. Anybody remember when we thought we had a pretty good handle on medical science until about March? And then you got some saying, science, turn to the science. Science has all the answers. And now you got somebody who seemed like a pretty decent person saying, actually, we withheld some information on the mask because we wanted to make sure the doctors got them. Yeah, we figured they could help. And so you're getting this mixed information from science. There's never going to be a time when everything is right and all science works and kicks on all cylinders. It's just we're flawed human beings. And so as long as we don't say, the answer is who we elect for the legislature, or if we get the right president in there, or if we get the right people on the Supreme Court, do we still have somebody in here who thinks the Supreme Court's going to solve our problems? Do you get the right one in? Man. So what we have to understand is we don't worship this. We worship God. And we serve Him. Now, I am not trying to tell you not to vote. I hope I've already established that. I'm not trying to tell you to be dismissive, but just keep everything in perspective. I don't live in a cancerous society. God may call us to that, but we'll get by because He's the one in control and He knows what He wants. And our job is to fit into His slots to serve Him. Can we do that? I think we can. And I think that's a pretty good way to sleep at night. We'll do what we can do. We'll serve. And God's going to take care of the rest. And it's going to be okay. So don't be anxious about tomorrow, please. Especially about the political process. You trust God. You go with God's flow. Find you a good medical doctor. I'm speaking symbolically. I hope you got a good one anyway, but I'm speaking symbolically. Find you a good medical doctor. Go see him. Go see her. But recognize they're limited. Get a second opinion. And remember who the instrument is to change the world. Our hope for racial equality, our hope to eliminate prejudice, our hope to deal with every problem of the world is not through Congress. It's through the church. And that's the way God set it up. And part of that process is to be able to love those who come at things from a different view. I've got dear friends who've been married now for almost 50 years. She votes one way, he votes the other. They cancel each other out. But they've got a marvelous marriage because they've elevated other things above theirs. I have a dream, folks. I have a dream that at a potluck we can have an officer in the U.S. Air Force who's a member of the church sit here and right beside him a conscientious objector. And they can eat in fellowship. Because they've got things in perspective. This is of the world where we are now, and this fellowship is above it. Is that a pretty good dream? All right. Well, God's going to get it together for us, and it's going to be okay. And I do believe God is at work. We're calling this series Holy Chaos. I did this a few years ago, if you're a guest. But I find it really describes what's going on. Are we in a world that's in chaos, folks? Amen. Is it from God? I don't know. Is it from human beings? I don't know. But I can tell you this. We're going to do the best we can to serve God, and we are going to get through this. And it's going to be okay. If we can encourage you, we want to do that. Let's all stand and let's sing.